wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello,
there we go.
Turn that down.
I can hear me.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that before.
That was
just a motet.
Let's go straight in.
All right.
I don't
really
know how I'm going to fix that.
There we go.
Oh, Alan. Oh. Oh,
musical journey.
Oh, what's going on?
With the performance of the Amber
Jam. Oh, dearie me. Hit reset.
Yeah, hold on.
Oh my god.
Singer songwriter Julian.
There, with us.
Oh my god.
Yeah, at least, I was going to say, at least we just got more of Alan's hearty laugh. Since you got it more.
All right.
Here we go. Okay. Here we go.
Takes two.
Let's try that again.
Indeed.
Oh my gosh.
Did we skip a bit? We jumped.
Yeah,
quite
we
a
have
bit.
Skipped a little bit. Hold on.
It was a mouse slip. There we go.
Yeah. Let's try and get back on track here.
We're nearly there, folks.
Right.
Little technical difficulty.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, let's just start chatting.
What the heck? What the heck? It can
that
take care of itself, can't it?
Beautiful, beautiful programming on my part.
Oh, God.
Well, we have a great Dear Science show today.
We can only hope.
Yeah, a great start. Anyway, we're talking all about birds today.
Yes.
We've got a couple interesting stories for us.
You
want to get started on your first one? You're talking about a newly discovered extinct species, which I didn't think they would discover those.
Yeah. So it's a very avian-themed Dear Science today. And you're absolutely correct. We're talking about a new bird that has been discovered out in the Chatham Islands. Now, those of you who know your birds hopefully know the paradise duck. Because
no.
Really?
No.
Well, I don't know
you
my
don't
birds.
Know the paradise duck? My goodness.
Oh, I'm going to Google it right now.
Oh, they are so cute. And they mate for life and everything, and they're extremely cute. And the ducklings, oh my goodness, they are ridiculous.
Oh,
cute.
I do now, yes.
Yeah. There we go. So it's called the paradise shell duck. And that's found all over New Zealand. Very, very distinctive call. If you hear them, you'll certainly know. And their population's been estimated between 600,000 and 700,000. So, you know, they're not in any danger or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, their mates over in the Chathams were not quite so lucky. And so some workers at Otago have found remnants of an extinct now shell duck, which was called the Rekuhu shell duck, or is called now the Rekuhu shell duck. And so they are thinking that the ancestors of this arrived in the Chathams around about 400,000 years ago, there or thereabouts, and sadly became extinct sometime prior to the 19th century when human habitation occurred, and they were then sadly, as were lots of things, I guess, the victims of overhunting and introduced predators, the rats and stoats and you know, all of those sorts of things. So but it's very interesting because they're very, very closely related to the paradise duck of the mainland, or this is at least what these workers from Otago are saying. But they say that the bones that they've found, they show that the shell duck was busy evolving, and it was evolving to have shorter wings than its mainland cousin and longer leg bones.
Yeah, so and it can't fly or anything.
Well, that's the thing. It's not so much that it can't fly, it's probably that it could fly. So they take it as a sign that it was heading towards flightlessness.
Mm-hmm.
So shorter wings and longer leg bones. So they're sort of thinking, well, the longer leg bones would make it easier for them to sort of get off the ground with these shorter wings.
So could possibly.
Wings.
So was it Schrodinger's duck? May or may not fly.
But, you know, not so much the problem, I guess, but the what was happening out on the Chathams is that there were lots of food. So these are herbivores, these the paradise duck certainly is in the mainland. So there's lots of food there and basically no predators. And so really you didn't have to fly. You could just sort of walk everywhere. And so they were getting into that. And you've got these horribly strong winds and everything over in the Chathams as well. So, you know, it's easier to sort of walk against a strong wind than it is to fly against one. And so that's what they're thinking, that these bones show, that really that it was on the way to evolving to become flightless. And, you know, the thinking behind that is, you know, why do you use lots of energy if you don't have to? And so, you know, that then becomes the basis of evolution. So this is kind of cute. And they also did studies of DNA from the bones and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, certainly it's related to the paradise shell duck of the New Zealand mainland. So, a shame it's gone, really.
I'm curious how they discovered this. Like,
I think they just dig around and, you know, there's something we haven't seen before, basically.
Yeah, I see.
This is the way that they do things, so, yeah.
Oh, okay. Very cool.
Very cool, yeah.
What's our next topic for the day? We're talking about birds singing for an extra hour, which
sound
nice to the ears, but doesn't sound like a good story. Did you want to talk about this one?
Well, it's getting to that time of the, you know, so the days are just getting a little bit longer. You're just sort of noticing it in the morning, and we certainly notice it down my way with the tui. You can hear them in the morning. They're busy squawking away and everything. It's a nice thing to wake up to. So there's a bunch of workers in the US, and they've just published a paper in the journal Science. So that's, you know, about your top science journal. And they're looking at the effects of light pollution on the activity patterns of birds. Okay, so how does that make a difference? You often watch, I think one of the things I often watch is sort of cricket, that's, you know, day-night cricket or something, and you see all these seagulls sort of flying around, you know, at the cricket and stuff like that, when they should be in bed, really. And so what these folk did, they looked at 583, count them, species of birds all around the world, and looking at the effect of light pollution on basically the habits of those birds, and in particular the amount of time spent singing. So when birds sing, it's quite, again, it's an energy intensive thing. You know, you try singing for half an hour or something like that, it takes it out of you. And so, you know, bird singing is energetically, or is energetic expenditure, and so they need to sort of make that up somehow. And what they found as a result of this study was that basically light pollution can increase the amount that birds sing by about an hour a day, which, you think about that, that's an awful lot. That's a heck of a lot of time that you're going to spend singing. So how did they do this? They did this through a sort of a citizen science project where people all around the world, bless them, subscribe to this thing, or they... What's the word? The word's gone. They submit to this thing called bird weather. Okay, so
yeah,
and they are recording bird songs from wherever they are, all around the world. They submit this to this thing called bird weather, and then on that, then AI identifies what the birds are from their songs. And these people have been recording their songs, and they've been keeping records of how long the birds have been singing for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so they had about 4.4 million calls, a database of about 4.4 million calls, and they whittled that down to these 583 different species of birds. And they were particularly interested in what time did they start singing in the morning, what time did they finish singing at night, and what were the light levels at the place where they were recorded. So, again, these dutiful people who, you know, are just amazing, doing this for absolutely nothing, you know, keeping all of these records, recording all these data and stuff, and, you know, I think that's absolutely fabulous. So what happened as a result of all of this, they found that the brightest places, so the ones with the most light pollution, that the birds in the morning, they would start singing on an average 18 minutes earlier than the birds in the dark places without any light pollution, and 32 minutes longer in the evening, again, compared to birds where there were, or where there was no light pollution, okay? And surprise, surprise, I guess this is sort of obvious in hindsight, but the birds with the largest eyes got affected the most.
Oh.
That kind of makes sense,
true,
doesn't it?
Yeah, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, it does. Of course it does, doesn't it? Yeah. But so the question then becomes, is this a good thing or a bad thing? You know, is it, and you can sort of look at it both ways. So, yes, they've found that this is what happens, but then does it disrupt the sleep? Okay, the fact that they're singing for longer, does that mean that they sleep for a shorter time, or do they merely then maybe they might take some naps in the day? So they, you know, they don't know whether that's the case or not. If they are up later at night with this extra light, that gives them extra time to forage, so that mm-hmm. could then, you know, be a good thing. We just don't know. But, you know, the data are now there. Light definitely makes a difference to the length of time that they are basically staying up during the day. So, and as often happens on deer sites, you know, more work is required. You know, more mm-hmm. more studies will be taken out. Watch the space.
Yeah, watch the space.
So,
interesting.
Yeah. So that's quite nice.
Yeah, that is quite an interesting story.
Yeah.
Your next story is a bit yuckier, but it is an interesting one. They've done some interesting research about. You know what? I'll let you explain. I don't really. Take it away.
Okay, so have either of you ever tried mutton bird?
Oh, no. I haven't.
But you
did it wrong for this.
And you've never?
No. Gosh, have you?
Yes. Oh. Yes, once.
Yeah, awesome.
Let's say it's an acquired taste. For those of you who don't know, the mutton birds are sort of endemic down just some islands off Stewart Island. So the Mutton Bird Islands, I believe they call them.
Yeah, the Mutton Bird Islands.
That's very fitting.
Not to be confused with the band. No, yeah.
Indeed, good point. Which came first? Yes. So, as I said, I've tried it once and it's extremely oily, very, very, very oily. I wouldn't say that I'd go back for seconds or anything. But mutton birds are a class of, they are sooty shearwaters. That's their sort of scientific name-ish. And so they're part of shearwaters. So there's a bunch of different types of shearwaters all around the world. And over in Japan, they've got a thing called the streaked shearwater, which is a relation of the mutton bird. You're busy looking it up on the phone.
Yeah, I'm Googling it. I just wanted to know if they're native to New Zealand.
I'm pretty sure they are. Pretty sure, but I could be wrong. But... So there were some Japanese scientists interested in basically the flights of these shearwaters, these streaked shearwaters, and how they fly. And that's a perfectly interesting thing to be interested in, isn't it? You know, that's kind of cool. So how would you check out how a bird flies? Why don't we use some cameras? Why don't we strap some cameras to the birds and let them go and see what they come back with? And so that was the point of this study originally.
Of course, they found something quite different to what they were expecting,
So the cameras were pointing downwards. So they're sort of on the breasts of the bird, I guess, so around the front. So they're hanging off the front. And what they often found was that instead of getting nice pictures of flight, they would get lots of pictures of these things pooping all over the show. And they sort of, birds have got to poop. So they kept watching this, and then they thought, whoa, hang on, they're pooping an awful lot.
Oh, God.
Like a lot.
And pooping in the ocean as well.
Oh, okay.
Way to turn you off it, really.
Yeah, accidentally swallow some water if you're swimming around there.
So these shearwaters, so they're nesting on sort of islands and stuff like that, and then they're flying out over the ocean and, you know, getting their food and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So what they found when they really got into it, they're like, oh, this looks even more interesting than, you know, just how they fly. And what they found was that these shearwaters, with one exception out of 195 poops, they were all over water.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
So they found that these things never pooped on the land. They always pooped over water.
That's
which is kind of interesting. I actually went out to the gannet colony at Muriwa for the first time ever the other day, which I thought was amazing. Boy, that smells. So I don't think your gannets, I think they could learn a thing or two off the shearwaters, I think. I think the gannets are pooping on land because they
in
do
the
smell.
Middle of your deep blue sea anchor mate. Yeah. Just do it there in the middle of deep blue sea. That was, mutton bird reference.
Indeed. So I said that they pooped a lot. They were pooping five times an hour, okay, which is quite a lot. And get this, they lose 5% of their body mass per hour.
Wow, on laxatives.
5%.
Wow.
Sounds like
that's
quite unsustainable.
Crazy.
Is extra. Well, it would be unsustainable if they weren't busy eating like clappers.
Wow.
So 5% of their body weight. So this... this was the results from 36 hours of aerial footage, which is quite a bit. And so they recorded 195 poops in that time. And again, as I said, all but one of them over water. So then the question becomes, well, why the heck do they poop so much? And so one of the things might be that it's easier to fly if you're lighter. Maybe. So again, it all comes down to energy, as we've talked about with the other two bird stories, you know, energetic thing. Why don't they poop on land? Well, you know, if you're pooping on land, then you're walking around in your own poop and everything like that. And so, you know, you're increasing the chances of sort of viral infections and bacterial infections and stuff like that. So if you're pooping over water, you're not going to have that problem. So, and also, you're talking about sort of pooping in the sea and how yuck it is. No, actually, it's good for the sea because poop is very, very rich in both nitrogen and phosphorus, which are both sort of essential elements for things like coral reefs, fish populations and stuff like that. So ultimately, they're probably, you know, on the whole, it's probably a plus that they're pooping in the sea and not over land. But boy, to lose 5% of your body mass per hour just through pooping, that to me is utterly extraordinary.
Quite surprising, I think.
And again, this is one of those serendipitous results that happens so often in science, when somebody is starting to look at one thing and then they just get entirely derailed when they get their results and think, oh, hang on, this, here's the interesting bit, you know, it's something way left field that they never thought of before they started. So you know, you can and do get lucky in science quite often. So
right on.
So I think that's quite cool.
Very cool.
There we go.
Did you hear about in Hong Kong they did a bird costume contest this week?
No, I did not hear. Oh, right. I missed a story, damn it.
Oh, no, yeah. I thought I'd share this when I saw it on the news yesterday. They did, people dressing up as birds and singing. And
New Zealand bird-themed bird week. That would be a good idea. We did that here.
Yeah, it's a very
go Hong Kong
bird-themed week in the news. Anyway, that is all of our stories for Dear Science today. Thank you so much, Alan, for joining us in studio. Thank you, as always, to MOTAT. And thank you, Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Nice day today. Is that Alan?
Alan! 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 Alan!